Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review. I'm Matt Alagaya. On the programme today, we're talking books. We'll venture from futuristic war zones to the anthropological effects of beer with the writer and critic Mark Mason and online editor of The Bookseller, Sarah Shaffey. Plus, later on in the programme, we'll be getting music in Buenos Aires as we take a tour to find out about the country's cumbia genre, and we'll meet Australian musician Robert Forster as he releases his memoir, Grant and I. That's all ahead on the Monocle Arts Review. Mark and Sarah, welcome to the show. And Sarah, we come to you first. American War is the debut title by journalist Omar El Akkad, which hurtles us into the future, where he imagines a second American Civil War set between 2074 and 2095. It's actually not too far-fetched to believe, is it? Is it, Sarah? Did this feel horribly timely?
It absolutely did. And I think the thing to say is it is a sort of dystopia because it's set in the future. Things have changed drastically, but absolutely all of it is completely believable, which is very scary. But the way El Akkad approaches it is just genius. The way he takes us through the life of one particular character as she is six when we start the story, go through her life into adulthood and learn how she becomes essentially a weapon of war and what makes her do that.
So how has America been divided into this civil war, if it's not giving too much away, I guess?
No, so it's not giving too much away. You do find out quite a lot of at the beginning because the story is narrated by the main character, Sarat's nephew. You're not given a history lesson at the beginning, but basically America is divided into North and South. They have disagreed over the use of fossil fuels, which I think is a discussion we're currently having. California seems to be part of something now called the Mexican Protectorate, and the rest of the world, the Buazizi Empire has sprung up, which is now the big superpower in the world. So the Middle East and also China is a major superpower. So those players are acting in the way that America and Europe currently act and have the powers that we currently experience.
Interesting. And you mentioned there that it's all very believable, right down to the fact that there's flooding in Florida in this book. I mean, it's extraordinary that this was released basically the week before the hurricanes hit Florida.
Absolutely. I mean, obviously, this was written before Trump, before the events of the last year or so, but you would be forgiven for thinking that the author was writing this as he went along and as he was experiencing the last 12 months. It is slightly scary, as I said before.
And you mentioned El Akkad there is a journalist who's reported from wars throughout the Middle East, including the Arab Spring. How does he bring that experience to the novel? Do you get the sense that this is a man who's he has seen war zones around the world?
Absolutely. And I think Sarat is such a sympathetic character. Some of the things that she does, well, a lot of the things that she does are horrific, but you completely understand where she's coming from. And I think you see that because Omar El Akkad has spoken to people in war zones and understands what you go through as far as somebody who is not a victim can do. So I think that really comes through in the novel.
There are some quite neat twists, I guess you would say. We have migrants who are actually still going across the Mediterranean, but in the opposite direction now, from Europe to Africa. Does that make it amusing, or is that kind of the author is actually making a point there about Western society and the way it's going?
I think it's more the latter. I think it's a great way to make people, to put people in the situation that migrants are currently going through and that refugees are currently going through. So a lot of what we read and hear about refugees in Syria is kind of just switched around to really make this about American refugees. And it's not inconceivable to think that the way power works is very fragile. So we could see, probably not this situation, but we shouldn't take for granted what we have.
Is there much about how China is the new baddie? Because America's always been the... It's basically whoever's biggest is the baddie in the world. So for decades, you know, almost a century, it's been America.
Yeah.
And it's going to be really intriguing this century as China takes over to see how America, people will start to feel sorry for it.
Yeah, so I don't want to give too much away, but certainly the power players in the book are from... Well, they're from the Buazizi Empire, so the Middle Eastern kind of block, as it were. And some of the things they do are not very good. Yeah. But obviously they are providing, at the same time, providing shelter and money and help, not always in good ways and going to the right people.
Okay, and just in terms of the written style of the book, I mean, does it feel quite journalistic? Is it, or is it? Does it enter into kind of high literary, I guess, yeah, flows at points?
It feels quite journalistic in that it's a story very well told, and like I said, it's narrated by the nephew of the main character, who is a college professor and kind of a history professor. So there's various documents brought in at various times, references from books and things as well. So you're getting a full picture.
American War by Omar El Akkad is out now, published by Picador. Mark, a bit of a change in tone for your first read this week. This is a new book by the British TV and radio personality Jeremy Vine. Amongst many things, he presents a daily programme on BBC Radio 2, on which he has calculated he's taken more than 25,000 phone calls, astonishingly, from the public on topical subjects since he started in 2003. In his book, What I Learned, What My Listeners Say and Why We Should Take Notice, he tries to compile what he has amounted from these conversations. Mark, that's a lot of phone calls. How does he sort this into a kind of a coherent narrative, a coherent book?
Thankfully, it's not all about the phone calls. I mean, that could have become just a rehash of all the calls from the show. There's a lot of him in it as well, which is fun.
And he's great. I mean, he's such a good
raconteur. Well, he does lots of different things, and that sort of keeps coming through. And he, you know, he flits around, much like the programme does, flicking between subjects very quickly. He does that with his own life. But the stuff from the listeners is good as well. Some of it's serious, you know, life lessons that they've learned. And he tries to, without getting too Alan Partridge about it, without thinking, you know, my listeners are the font of all wisdom. You know, there's some funny stuff in there and just incredible experiences that can happen. One of his callers was in an ambulance one. There was a patient in an ambulance being driven along. And the driver of the ambulance noticed that people were overtaking him and conking their horns and trying to get his attention. And he realised that his ambulance had caught fire. Under the bottom of the ambulance had caught fire. So the ambulance driver pulls off at the nearest point he can, which happens to be a petrol station.
Oh my God.
And then all the members of staff in the ambulance just leg it, get away from ambulance as quickly as they can, and forget about the patient in the back. Thankfully, obviously, he was rescued in time because he was calling Jeremy Vine to tell him about it.
That's
so there are those incredible sort of stories.
I mean, the title of the book, you know, What My Listeners Say and Why We Should Take Notice, there's a sort of call to action there. I mean, what do you get a feeling that this is a polarized country, and is he trying to say we should really be listening to all sections of society? Is that what message comes through?
Like I said, there's a bit of that. Thankfully, not too much. Not like I say, not trying to say that my listeners are can cure all society's problems. There's, you know, some incredible experiences, people who've had great tragedies in their lives, but then it thankfully. Even when he's talking about those sort of things, there's always moments of humour as well.
But just to come back to that point, so he's not kind of saying the answer to why Brexit happened is there or something like that, because I guess, you know, speaking to that many people over that many years, you would get quite an extraordinary cross-section of British society.
Yeah, and of course the nature of a phone-in is that you want balance, so you're always getting both sides of the debate, so it's not as though you're just getting one side all the time. You're not going to get... If anything, and I think this does come across, it reminds you that there's always two sides to a story. And, you know, there was one about child safety, and there'd been a ridiculous clampdown on people climbing trees because of child safety. And he... gives all the statistics and says, you know, someone had come on and done some great statistical analysis of why it had been an overreaction. And he says, but there was the one caller who knew someone who'd been paralysed by falling out of a tree. And it doesn't take away from the statistics, but equally it shows you there's always a human element to it as well. So, yeah, nice balance in there.
Jeremy Vine's What I Learned, What My Listeners Say and Why We Should Take Notice is published by Orion and is out now. Out at the end of August was the new book by award-winning novelist Maggie O'Farrell, only this time she's tackling the memoir. I Am, I Am, I Am, 17 Brushes with Death, tells stories from her life through 17 near-death experiences. Sarah, this is one of your picks this week. What sort of paths does O'Farrell take us down here?
So, I mean, this is a book that does what it says on the tin. So it's 17 chapters, each one takes a different incident in her life where she came close to death, and you... go from childhood to adulthood, back to teenage years, and back and forth. So it's not a straightforward chronological biography. And so the first one, she's 18, I think, and she's working. She goes out on a walk and encounters a man, and she just gets this feeling that she is in danger. And she manages to get away, but she later discovers that man killed another girl in sort of a similar circumstance. So, and she says in the book that death brushed past her on that path that day so close that she was almost able to touch it. And you go through childhood illnesses, accidents, and various other near-death experiences.
And why do you think it's not in a chronological order? I mean, does it, I guess the way it's told, does it tell a different narrative?
Yeah, it's really a book about how humans are very vulnerable, but also at the same time, incredibly strong and can get through a lot. So you do go back and forth. You're not always told everything about that incident either. So there's a childhood illness which you learn about, but you're never told exactly how she comes out of it. And in any normal biography, we would have learnt all about the years of recovery and the overcoming of those problems. But here it's really about that particular time when that happened to her, and then everything else. You know she survives because she's written this book, so it is about survival, but that's a given, I think.
And 17 chapters all facing death in this way.
It's extraordinary.
She's quite unlucky, isn't she?
Well, exactly, yeah. First of all, she's quite unlucky. But also, as a reader, does it become a little bit repetitive, do you think?
Not at all. Everyone is completely different. And I think from the example I gave about the encounter, I think perhaps all of us are closer to death sometimes than we thought we might be. And it's a real reflection on kind of life and how we live.
And is that the kind of concluding thought, I guess, when you get to the end of it, that you think, wow, I've probably had a few more scrapes actually than I was aware of? Maybe I should be very grateful that I'm alive.
I think the latter, that it sounds like it should be quite a depressing book because it deals with death, but it's actually really hopeful and about how we can survive and how we do every day. You know, you cross roads and you get on planes and you survive illnesses, but for the slightest thing, it might not have been that way.
And we kind of touched on a couple of the 17 chapters. We talked about her childhood illness. Are there any others that kind of really, really stood out as extraordinary incidents or events?
So she has, I think, two children, I'm writing saying. So there's a chapter there where she experienced an extremely, extremely difficult childbirth, which I think is something a lot of people know, someone who might have been through something similar. We all know people that have had children. And then another one which I thought stood out was quite near the beginning, where she goes swimming. And I think that's one of those where you can really think, I've swum in that kind of a situation, and actually that could so easily have happened to me. And I think that's where the strength of the novel lies, in that you can really imagine yourself going through something similar.
I Am by Maggie O'Farrell is out now, published by Tinder Press. Finally, we have Beeronomics, How Beer Explains the World, a title by economist and professor Johan Swinnen and journalist Devin Brisky that explores the key innovations that propelled the industrialization of the beer market. Mark, this was one of yours. That description might turn a lot of people off this book. What did you like about this?
I liked the beer bits rather than the anomic bits.
Okay.
In fairness, as you say, a lot of people could be turned off this book. You should only read this if you're interested in economics and if you know a lot about it. Not if you know a lot about it, but if you want to learn about it. And there's a lot of stuff in there about investment strategies, about market consolidation, all those things that are in the business section of the newspaper, you know. Hmm. But then it does, if you widen out a bit from that, it does set it all in context. It goes back thousands of years about how, you know, what enabled brewing to take place was farming and all that sort of stuff, because, you know, the hops and when hops came into it, and the history of it, and the oldest narrative tale that we know of, the Epic of Gilgamesh, which is 4,000 years old now, the oldest known narrative work. Its protagonist, Enkidu, I hope I've pronounced that correctly, Enkidu. At one point, he drinks 7 jugs of beer and he becomes, and I quote from the epic itself here, he became expansive and sang with joy. We've all known nights like that in the pub. And ancient Egyptians used to drink their beer through straws because it was unfiltered. They hadn't yet got a way of filtering out all the gunky bits that you're left with. So they would just poke a straw through the top and drink it like that. So it takes you back into history, and lots of language in there as well. You know, I didn't even know until I read this that the very word beer comes from barley, obviously one of the main ingredients. And lager is German for to store, because they came up with a different way of producing it where they stored it in cold caves for a long time. And, you know, it does, like, if you're interested enough in the economics to be reading it, you will also get all this other sort of stuff out of it as well.
And I guess the last kind of 50 years, if it goes that modern,
yeah,
is all about kind of huge, huge groups and Ambush in Bev and all of those people, S.A.B.
Yeah.
Miller.
Yeah.
Is that interesting, or is that, does that feel like the back pages of the FT?
That's, again, you should only be reading that probably if you're an FT reader. But again, there are some interesting moments as well. Like the head of one of the big American groups in the States, he's insisted on doing the advert for it himself that's going to be shown in the Super Bowl. And he has to be told that it hasn't tested very well, and you know his ego isn't going to respond too well to it. And they're going to play another advert as well. And again, back into the way that television worked as well. The nature of this sort of book, when it's done well, and as I say, if you're interested in economics, I think this is done well, this book, it sort of branches off into other areas. Like it starts talking about the early days of TV in the States. And the beer companies were among the first companies to realise the power of advertising. So they were sponsoring the coverage. And then, of course, you get the little side detail in that of how the Brooklyn Dodgers got their name. It never occurred to me to ask why the Brooklyn Dodgers are called the Brooklyn Dodgers. It's because apparently people in Brooklyn were very good at getting out of the way of trolley cars. They were known for being, because there were lots of trolley cars in Brooklyn, they were very good at dodging out of their way at the last minute. So, like I say, if you're interested in the serious stuff, you'll get all this other stuff as well.
Interesting. I mean, I guess it's one of those clever ways of looking at history, going through something that really has been present in almost everyone's lives for 2,000 years at least,
more than that.
So it sounds like 4,000 years. Do you think that kind of history actually really works? That you can get into different areas that you wouldn't necessarily be able to if you were doing a straight history?
Yeah, definitely. Mm. It's that old trick of taking one aspect of life and branching. And like I say, it does branch out very well. And also reminds you just how different life was back then. You know, we all know in theory that it was different. And then you hear specific examples like the phrase small beer. It was a very particular sort of beer. Basically, it was very weak beer, also known as table beer. And that was the beer that children used to drink. You know, and very often, although some historians dispute this, it's said that they used to drink that because the water was so unsafe. If you were drinking the beer, it was a lot safer because it had been brewed and all the impurities had come out. So, it takes you back to how different life can be. And then also just how much we were at war. One of the stats that brought me up short was we learned that Britain was at war for 91 of the 127 years. Between 1689 and 1815, Britain was at war for 91 of those 127 years, mostly against France. But a lot of it was paid for by the taxes on beer because it had become such a tax. It's one of those things you can tax and people aren't going to stop doing it. Right. And they said that for ages about cigarettes and they finally stopped. It's stopping. Beer, it still seems to be going strong and is a great source of tax revenue to this day.
And how global is this look at the world of beer? I mean, do we stay mostly in Europe with kind of Bavaria and the Low Countries, or do we end up in Japan with Japanese brewers as well?
Yeah, and going back to the very beginning, like I say, the Egyptians, there's some early Sumerian art that shows women drinking beer during sex, which I'm sure that's not completely unknown these days, but it's not as common certainly as it was in Sumerian times for them to put it in their art. So yeah, it goes back. There's the Japanese stuff's in there as well. I think my favourite stuff was from the European stuff. This Trappist monks were big brewers of beer, and there's still one beer called, I'm not going to pronounce it, it begins with a W, and then it's ABT-12, and it's regularly voted by beer purists, one of the top 10 beers in the world, but it's still made by the monks in this monastery in rural Belgium, and you're only allowed to buy one case. You have to make an appointment a year in advance. You have to turn up at the door of the monastery. You are allowed to buy your case of this beer, and you have to promise to drink it, not to sell it. Now, of course, because it's one of the world's top 10 beers, if you look at eBay, I think you'll find that not everybody sticks to the promise.
That's beeronomics, though.
To drink it. Well, absolutely, yeah. They can't complain, the monks, really.
Exactly, fantastic. Johan Swinnen and Devin Briskey's Beeronomics, How Beer Explains the World, is out now, published by Oxford University Press. We're nipping over to South America for some music. The musical genre of cumbia is universally popular across Latin America. Based on a catchy, danceable beat, the style has crossed borders and evolved into distinct regional flavours. A new cultural tour in Buenos Aires is offering to take visitors on a musical trip through the origins of cumbia in the city, exploring its influences, meeting musicians, and attending shows. Monocle's Frederick Bernas joined the first ever group to go on the tour.
Sitting in the back of a van, heading away from Buenos Aires towards the outer provinces, is not where most visitors to the Argentine capital would expect to find themselves on a Friday night. We're leaving behind a city which is spoiled for nightlife to find the roots of a musical movement. Our guide is Elfanta, a producer who works with some of the biggest names in the cumbia business.
Hablando de los estilos en Santa Fe, se inventó un estilo.
He explains how the distinctive style of cumbia santafesina, which we're listening to now, comes from myriad influences. In the 1970s, musicians from the city of Santa Fe blended traditional cumbia, which originates in Colombia, with the sound of rising rock bands like the Beatles and the Eagles. They wanted to be rockers, but couldn't bring themselves to abandon their cherished cumbia. So they played shimmering electric guitars and layered vocal harmonies over a classic backbeat, which stresses the 2 and 4.
Cumbia is Latin America's biggest rhythm.
That's Grant C. Duell, the tour organizer. He's the founder of ZZK Records, a trend-setting label that specializes in Latin music.
Cumbia is a kind of an American representative of the New World. By American, I mean obviously the whole two continents. It's a mashup of indigenous culture, European culture, and African culture. It's a perfect representation of the idea of America. It's this kind of this melting pot of rhythms and styles and ideas into something new.
ZZK works with many artists who fuse the sound of cumbia with electronic beats and heavy bass. The tour concept is granting unique access to a subcultural community, offering a real inside view of how the music gets made and where it comes from. Our first stop is San Fernando, a town in the Buenos Aires province which is famed for its cumbia scene. We visited the home studio of El Mudo, whose artist name means the mute. He comes from a group of musicians who play cumbia villera, which roughly translates as slum cumbia. The style flaunts its working class identity with a rebellious pride. Many of its anthems are characterized by a fiercely political edge, and El Mudo seeks to follow that tradition.
Se trata de lo que estamos viviendo en la Argentina hoy y lo que se vivió y lo que se viene viviendo hace varios años.
My music is about what's happening in Argentina, not only today, but over the last few years. I talk about reality in the streets and humble neighborhoods, things that happen to people every day. We sing about politics as a form of resistance. For example, one of my songs is called Cumbia Not to Forget, because the music was censored back in 2001 during the economic crisis in Argentina. The government didn't like us protesting against corrupt politicians.
Tanta mentira hay en la ciudad, que el que tiene más cada vez quiere más. Tanta mentira hay en el país, que el pobre siempre lucha para poder vivir. Hay tanta desigualdad.
After leaving the studio, we go for pizza with another local hero, known as El Chino. As an ex-prisoner, he writes music about the grittier side of things: crime, drugs, violence, and escaping the police. He tells us plenty of tall tales about the rivalry between famous cumbia bands who would even raid each other's hotels while on tour. It's clear that with El Chino and his friends, art reflects life, and he has no reservations about opening up. For Karin Gorayev, a Swedish expat living in Buenos Aires, that kind of intimacy sets the ZZK tour apart.
In touristic places, in most tours that you do, the people that you go and visit, they know what to expect, they behave in a certain way, they adapt to the tourist and to the product that they have to sell, whereas in this situation, it was totally not the case. We were invited into these people's homes. It was a genuine social setting where we were sharing space and time and food with them. It was a true, authentic experience.
After dinner, we return to the city. Our final destination is a cavernous club in the Palermo neighborhood, where hundreds of people turned out for a night of, you guessed it, live cumbia. Although it's always been popular across the Americas, Grant C. Duell believes the rest of the world is slowly waking up to the Latin scene.
In the late 90s, you had a kind of a Latin explosion happening, and now I think recently Latin music is also having its moment, obviously. The number one song right now in the world is a reggaeton song, Despacito, which I don't even want to talk about because the song is so infectious and it's going to be back in my mind. So yeah, I think it's an interesting time where these sounds are becoming kind of just more universal and less niche-y and less sticking to one region. It's kind of this global phenomenon.
ZZK Records has certainly played a part in that, with nearly 10 years of releasing music, including many artists who have received international acclaim. The new tour is a way of taking people behind the scenes, opening a fascinating window onto the cultural landscape of Argentina today. For Monocle, in Buenos Aires, I'm Frederick Bernas.
Thanks very much, Frederick. The next ZZK music tour takes place on September 20th and is running regularly throughout the rest of the year. The musician Robert Forster's new book, Grant and I, is not merely a memoir of Forster's time in influential Australian group The Go-Betweens, but an extended elegy to the band's other founder, Grant McLennan, who died suddenly in 2006, aged 48. It's also a meditation on male friendship and youthful ambition, and how both of those things look from an older and wiser place. Robert came to Midori House and spoke to Andrew Muller.
Every band romanticizes their beginnings. And you hear it.
As does every romantic relationship,
yeah, exactly,
of course.
Yeah, exactly. But I hear it all the time. You know, people talk about the first year or two after, you know, and then 10 years in a band. Or, you know, even when you're just talking to local bands in Brisbane, where I'm from. And they'll go, oh, you know, they get a look in their eye, you know, back in 2005 when we're doing our first gigs. And there's just something about that time, I think, that, which is, you know, like when Grant and I started the band, we always look back on that time very, very fondly and, you know, romanticized it, yeah.
But when you were considering that period, especially for the book, did it strike you as, I mean, not surprising because it's not surprising because it happened, but retrospectively incredible that the two of you had this dauntless confidence in the idea, because I think it's very hard to appreciate at this distance, though the book does a very good job of demonstrating that, what an unlikely and inhospitable milieu that Brisbane in the late 1970s was for such things.
Yeah. There was the political climate, which was very right-wing at the time. There was a right-wing government in there that was like fundamental Christian for two decades. And so the Go-Betweens grew out of that city. So there's that on one side, but there's also the side of two university students. Grant, when we started the band, didn't play any instrument. And so I'd only just started writing my first song. So you've got these two things going on, this unlikely, it's the most unorthodox beginning to a band that you could ever imagine, because neither of us had done any apprenticeships in pubs, or we couldn't play the blues or any of those type of things. And at the same time, we're in this sort of repressive city, you know, like ruled by this government. So it's all unlikely. And I think, like, this one thing I found about writing the book was that unusual start of the band, the fact that it was so unorthodox, goes all the way through our career in a way. You know, there's a sense of being dreamers and unreality and not being road warriors that sort of runs all the way through, really.
When you're putting the book together, and the book obviously is called Grant and I, you give him a star billing, and it's not just a history of the band, it is a history of a male friendship as well. But it's obviously a story which the other participant is not going to be able to tell. Yeah. How difficult was it to try and see things from his point of view? Or did you just decide, no, I'm just going to tell it the way it seemed to me and let the facts, or at least my understanding of them, speak for themselves?
Oh, that's a very good question. For the actual, this is going sideways a little bit. I didn't do much research for the book. It's everything that I remembered I thought was important. And so it's not, oh, you know, on the 3rd of October 1986, we drove from, you know, Adelaide to, you know, Melbourne, and I bought a hamburger at, you know, a truck stop there. But I was aware of that this is my version of it. And I was aware that there was times when Grant would probably shake his head. but that was part of our friendship. You know, there would be times when I'd look at him and I'd sort of go, you know, just not doubts, but, you know, like he'd sort of say something and I'd sort of go, oh, really? And he'd do the same with me. But I felt a great sense of responsibility telling the story without him and trying to do his music, his songwriting, and our friendship justice. That was maybe, you know, the biggest weight or just presence on my shoulder.
Did you find yourself wondering how different a book called Robert and I would have been if Grant had written it?
I haven't. It'd be longer than mine because Grant was someone who was very, more so than me, very confident of what he did and had an arrogance to him that people know about. So I don't think it'd be a 200-page, very, you know, fine poetic thing. I think he'd go a little bit more blockbuster. That's really all I could say about the book, really. I don't know how much it'd... I think it'd be more poetic. Like Grant was... I think it's like his songs, in a way. You know, the difference in our songwriting. Grant was a lot more conventionally poetic. Grant strained for images and was... Well, I was a little bit more conversational, perhaps. So I think his book would have been perhaps a little bit more consciously literary than mine.
Do you still feel like, and this is possibly me projecting slightly, thinking about my own experiences of various bereavements, do you still feel like you have a sort of ongoing relationship with Grant? Yeah. Is yeah. he still a living presence in that sense to you?
Yes, yes. What he is, I only realized this the other day, what he is, he's a lasting influence on me. You know, like when I look at a film or I listen to music or I read a book, I know that there's a part of what I'm looking at and how I'm appreciating is what Grant taught me. And so he remains like, not a mentor is too strong a word, but when I first met him, he was just, you know, the most amazing 18-year-old you're ever going to want to meet, because he was just fully loaded with knowledge and I was the bumpkin beside him. But he's sort of, you know, just films, books, he's an influence. He's a lasting influence on me. And I, you know, and that's beautiful. That's the sort of presence, you know. He's like a, again, this is probably going too far, but he's like a great university professor that you had who sort of said things and did things and made you look at art in a certain way. And then 20, 30 years later, well, it's 10 years since he died, that voice is still there. You know, look at that, hear that. It's still there, I can feel it.
Thinking about the book in terms of framing your own story, when you were going back and looking back at all this stuff, did you find any of it, how to put it, surprising you? Were there things that you just hadn't thought about for decades and decades, and all of a sudden you find yourself remembering, oh yeah, that happened, I did that?
I think how unorthodox the start of the band was and the influence that had on us all the way through, just that we weren't two musicians who meet through a notice board at a practice room. Do you know what I mean? And also how conceptual the band was. It was all the things that we loved in movies and literature and things like that. I taught him to play the bass. You know, you throw the Monkees in there, you throw Samuel Beckett in, you throw the Velvet Underground in, and we got all these ideas running. It's not a conventional way you start a band, but that doesn't then die at the end of the first year. Do you know what I mean? That's still when, you know, if you'd have met us in 2002 or something, we would still come across as those type of guys. And the other thing was, I learned through the book of how traumatic the breakup was for Grant. I think that, like, the breakup of the band, he was in relationship with Amanda, who was the violin player in the Go-Betweens. And, you know, the day that we announced that we want to stop the band and restart the band as it was back in 1978, she left him. And I think that, you know, just writing through that period, I just and listening to his solo albums he made after, the two that he made after, which are very much concerned with Amanda, that really hit me, you know, how much that changed him.
The portrait of Grant that you sketch in the book in that period is quite unsparing. I mean, it's sympathetic, but it doesn't stint on the detail of what he was going through. Again, was there any temptation to back off from that a little bit?
No, I wasn't there for part of it because between the period we're talking, like 1990 to 1992, I was living in Germany. So I was on the phone to him. I was listening to his records, you know, like we're writing faxes to each other and things like that. But I knew that he was going through turmoil in Sydney. He's the one that really missed the band. That's something that I realised. Like, Lindy could survive, Amanda could survive, I could survive. And with that breakup the way that it was, Grant was the one with no coping mechanism of what to do, you know. And I think the band also gave Grant, you know, the great artistic dreamer, something to do all the time. It was like, you know, we're going on tour. Yes, we're going into it, do an album. It gave him a routine for this sort of, this very ungrounded, otherworldly person. The band was a constant where Amanda could go off, you know, it was very difficult for her, but she could start again. Lindy started again. I started again, you know, got married and et cetera. Where with Grant, it was like once the band left, he floated dangerously. I think he missed the friendship of the band and the routine, you know, that came when I was writing. I just went, God, he really did miss the band. Just, you know, tour, album, tour, album, tour, album. He could have gone on and done that until he was 70 because it just, reality was gone and he could just be on that cycle, which he loved.
It's that precise thing, of course, which drives a lot of people in bands completely round the twist, is that cycle of album, tour.
Yeah, yeah. But he liked that because he couldn't construct really a home life and a home situation through relationships, etc., that would draw him away from it, really. Up and down through the streets of your town. Every day I make my way through the streets of your town. Round and round, up and down through the streets of your town.
That was Robert Forster, whose book Grant and I is out now. Now, as always, we're ending the show with this week's Global Countdown, and Fernando is back with us to talk us through the top 5 singles of another country around the world. Hi, Faye.
Hello, Matt. How are you? Hello, everyone.
Where are we heading?
We're heading to Indonesia.
Amazing.
I realize, you know, it's such a big, strong music market, and I haven't covered it yet. It's a good top 5, I have to say. Don't be scared, because there's a lot of Western artists, but the number one, it's a very unusual one, so prepare for the countdown.
Fantastic. Okay, so we should start with number 5 then, I guess.
Yeah, number 5, we have a Londoner, Dua Lipa with New Rules. You know, she's doing extremely well, and I really like her voice. I think she does have a lot of depth to it, and she writes great pop songs as well. Number 4, I don't know what you guys think about, is Maroon 5. They've been going on for a while. I understand they have a market, but to me, their songs can be a bit generic in some ways. The song's called What Loves Do, and is in partnership with American singer SZA. Number 3, Taylor Swift. I mean, we're going to be talking about Taylor Swift for a long time, I think. And number 3 is Look What You Made Me Do, her new single. You know, I know some of the fans didn't like, you know, it's a bit of a darker Taylor Swift in a way. You know, the lyrics talk about revenge and everything. I quite like it, especially because she sampled I'm Too Sexy by Right Said Fred, which is always a good thing.
They're happy about it as well, I think.
They're very happy.
Your little penny will be going into the bank account.
No, and Taylor, she's always smart. She actually talked to them before. It's like, you know, I'm going to use it. Because, you know, there's always like some problems in the industry, people sampling without asking for authorization. But she knew what
she
was
doing.
You
know the Noel Gallagher story about that? Oasis one once, where on the third album, I think, the album after What's the Story, Noel Gallagher had got this drum beat that he wanted the drummer to copy exactly. So he said, just we'll play it in your cans and you play over the top of it. So there'll be an exact copy, but you'll have played it, so we won't have to pay them. And then, fine, it worked like that. And then the drummer went and did an interview where he said what they'd done. So Noel Gallagher said, you idiot, we're going to have to pay them now.
Yes. Well, Taylor Swift will not need to pay anything. Well, number 2 is, again, Taylor Swift, Ready For It, her second single from the upcoming album Reputation. And it's funny, you know, it's reaching all the way to Indonesia. Shall we listen to a little bit of the number 1 song? I want to hear your opinion on it.
Fantastic.
Let's hear it.
Very nice.
It is. And usually, because, you know, all the tracks that we've been covering, it's usually like, you know, big beats, but this is quite a jazzy, relaxed song.
It's quite a 70s song. I can imagine that being lots of singers that my mother would have liked in the 70s. Do that for, and, it, you know, good tune in there. And
Quite folky. They are quite influenced by folk, they said. It's a group called Payung Teda. It's like four men in the group. And they met, I think, at university. So I think they identify as kind of indie, folk, jazz. You know, it's certainly not kind of tropical house or the things we're hearing. The song is called Akad. And I did translate the song because, of course, it was in Indonesian. It's very sweet. I mean, it's like, I think it talks a man, you know, in love with his wife. He says, I want you to be my wife, walk with you in the rain. And then at the end, you're my friend, you're my wife.
It's
very sweet. It's
very
so gentle.
Yes,
I think that needs to find a place on the Monocle 24 playlist, doesn't it?
I think so as well. You know, it's about love in a most innocent way. Sometimes it's good.
Thanks very much, Faye. That was terrific. That was the Global Countdown there with Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And I'm afraid that brings us to the end of today's programme. Thanks very much to my guests, Mark Mason and Sarah Shaffy. The show was produced by Holly Fisher, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and I'm Matt Alagaya. To play us out, let's have some more of that number one track from Indonesia. This is Payung Teda with Akad. Thanks for listening. Agar ku tak berharap dan buat kau